Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
CeraVe Facial Moisturizers with SPF protect skin against damaging UV rays and continuously deliver three essential ceramides to help restore skin's protective barrier so it can lock in moisture. Non-greasy, fragrance-free, and won't clog pores? With CeraVe, skin feels hydrated and looks healthy all day. CeraVe Facial Moisturizers with SPF from the number one dermatologist-recommended facial moisturizer brand.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
In recent years, the niqab has emerged as one of the most ubiquitous symbols of everything that is perceived to be wrong with Islam: barbarity, backwardsness, exploitation of women, and political radicalization. Yet all these notions are assigned to women who wear the niqab without their consultation. So-called niqab debates are held without their voices being heard, and when they do speak, their views are dismissed. Wearing the niqab, Muslim women in the UK and the US brings niqab wearers' voices to the fore, discussing their narratives on religious agency, identity, social interaction, community, and urban spaces. Anna Piella situates women's accounts firmly within UK and US social political contexts, as well as within media discourses on Islam. The picture painted by the stories told here demonstrates that, for these women, religious symbols such as the niqab are deeply personal, freely chosen, multi-layered, and socially situated. In our conversation, we discussed religious explanations for wearing niqab, public notions of what constitutes religious practice, mainstream media's image of niqab wearers, niqabi inclusive journalism, contradictions between religious perspectives and secular frameworks, Muslim use of social media, religious identity and pious dress, and intersections of racism and sexism with wearing the niqab. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. And now here's my conversation with Anna Piella about her book, Wearing the Niqab, Muslim Women in the UK and the US, published with Bloomsbury in 2021. Welcome, Anna. Thanks for joining me on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you?
I'm very good. And thanks for having me on the podcast.
Yeah. Very excited to talk to you about your book, Wearing the Niqab. Before we get into the book, we always start a little with our author's background. So can you tell us how you got into Islamic studies? Were there moments or mentors that kind of shaped, you know, the topics you pursue or how you approach them?
Sure. It's quite a lengthy story, so I'll give you a short version of that. Probably a long story with most people, but my undergraduate degree was in, my major was in politics, but I found that a very, very dreary topic, the way it was sort of served up at my alma mater. So I was really, really interested in programs and courses that were being delivered sort of in parallel beside me, so to speak, in neighboring institutes and departments. And I really, really got interested in a program which was called, I think, Middle Eastern Studies. So that's where I ended up writing my thesis. And that's where I realized that, you know, there's more to it in terms of politics. That politics was sort of taught in a much more fascinating and engaging way over there. So I was still technically a politics student, but you know, I went to a lot of lectures and workshops over there. Also, one of my good friends from college was she was studying Turkish studies. So I would hang out with her, and I would, you know, sometimes just you know, like flick through her books. And again, you know, that was my first sort of academic sort of contact with Islamic studies. That was one of her courses. So when I graduated, I decided that, you know, this is what I would like to sort of continue in grad school. And I moved to England, and I started grad school at the University of York. My my advisor was Professor Hale Asher, and she was you know, one of the sort of big stars of Islamic studies in the UK. She was advising on the topic of Islamic feminism. And so, yeah, at the time, the idea of digital religion was a very sort of new and fresh idea. And I became interested in the, you know, at first I was sort of browsing through a lot of web pages related to Islam, and I realized that a lot of them had women as a sort of discrete category, along with like food and customs, and you know, that seemed a little strange to me, because, you know, to just put like half the population of a religious tradition as a sort of category, you know, and I started asking the questions that, you know, now those of us who teach sort of digital religion always kind of, you know, suggest to students, you know, who might be the author of that page, who is missing, you know, what are the silences. And so I sort of figure, and maybe I instinctively sort of felt, that women themselves, if they were authors of such a website, they would not put themselves as a category. It felt distinctly sort of male made, this sort of digital production. And so, you know, I deduced that there must be corners of the, you know, virtual sphere that women, you know, women inhabit. And that's how my PhD project really was born, that I went and I found there were closed groups, email groups, that was before, you know, social media and Web 2.0. So these women were kind of collaborating and interacting, discussing Islamic sources. And so really that project was very much a sort of sociology of religion project, in that, you know, I wasn't looking at it from a theological perspective myself, but I was more interested in analyzing how women, Muslim women themselves, developed their own theologies. So that was my first book. And yeah, I mean, it went from there. After I published my first book, I got a job at a small sort of liberal arts college in England. I was teaching religious studies in Islam, and you know, that was the sort of place where all the debates about the niqab, which was the topic of my second book, were very relevant, because that was in the north of England, in a city called Leeds, next to Bradford. And that's a region of England that has a high percentage of, you know, of British Muslims. So there were quite a lot of women who wore the niqab. On the one hand, you know, I could sort of see them sort of moving around the sort of social geographic space, but also there was a lot about that in the media and in the politics. So should I continue just sort of to explain the rationale of the book?
So this is really interesting, knowing this kind of larger background. When you read this book, you really tie these kind of digital spaces, sociological spaces, political spaces, media spaces, really seamlessly throughout the book, wearing the niqab, in the sense that you kind of both kind of analyze how outsiders or non-Muslims are talking about this subject, but then also how women are understanding and expressing this in a kind of variety of ways to different audiences. But yeah, this is good to know. How, can you talk a little bit about how the book kind of, it sounds like it was sparked by the conversations around you, but when did you decide, okay, this is something that I'm going to put together as a book?
So in 2013, there was a big controversy, I believe, around elementary school teachers wearing the niqab at work. Those sort of events always sparked a bigger sort of public conversation about, you know, should we ban the niqab like the French did, or, you know, is it compatible with the so-called British values? And those debates, those kind of conversations were always incredibly aggressive, incredibly negative toward the women who chose to wear the niqab. And one very sort of characteristic feature of those conversations was that, at least in 2013, I don't recall a single woman invited to a TV studio or even asked to comment in a newspaper article. So that to me was shocking, because, you know, I expected a sort of, you know, sort of journalistic principles being upheld, that you ask people, you know, not just one side of the conversation, right? That everybody gets a say. And here we had a situation where certainly not everybody got a say. And I would say those women were central to the whole conversation. Like, how could you exclude them, given that they, you know, presumably would have had to say the most, you know, as people who actually experience this, people who engage in this religious practice. And of course, you know, I understand that the stereotype of the, you know, the silent Muslim woman or the subjugated woman who does not have a voice really played out in, I think, in this. And so there was nothing in the media that I could find that would engage these women. So I thought, okay, so maybe the academic sources, maybe there will be some articles or some books about this, you know, maybe somebody interviewed them. And I was shocked to be honest, to see that the situation was the same. So there was quite a lot of research about the experiences of hijab wearing, but as far as the niqab, there was nothing. Maybe one or two sort of interviews in a larger corpus of, you know, maybe 20 interviews, 18 of which would be with women who wore the hijab, and one or two with women who wore the niqab. But, you know, the niqab really was not sort of tackled in terms, you know, as a sort of centrally as a religious practice. So, you know, I figured, you know, this was worth, it was, you know, so basically I had to write that book that I couldn't find, you know, I couldn't find that book. And I wanted to tackle this, you know, from a different perspective. So I wanted to start with the women. And I was kind of really, really keen on giving or sharing the agenda with them. My preference would have been to just talk about their, you know, religious experience and what they think about it, and completely leave behind the sort of political layer of it. But you know, it's impossible, because in those accounts, in the interviews, the political stuff came up anyway, because you know, everything is dialogic, nothing is outside of a context, so that context inevitably had a role, and, you know, it's but I tried to put their experiences and their arguments sort of as a starting point and in the center, and not to sort of be overtaken by the other stuff, because, you know, there was actually quite a lot of academic literature, scholarship about, you know, the legal aspect of niqab wearing. There were quite a lot of those articles that didn't rely on interviews with women, but, you know, they were just analysis, sort of a humanistic analysis that, you know, talked about, you know, human rights, or, you know, there was even a whole sort of bunch of articles written by kind of medical researchers talking about, you know, does the niqab have an impact on vitamin D production or on driving and ice and things like that. So yeah, there was like practically every social science and humanities discipline and beyond had something about the niqab, but without, you know, women's voices. So you know, that's how this came mm-hmm. about. And I partnered with a Muslim women's NGO. It was called Muslim Women's Council, and so they sort of introduced me to quite a lot of my interviewees. Not all of them, but quite a few through their events, and you know, I was able to just tag along and introduce myself, and quite a few women were interested in the project, so they ended up you know, being interviewed. But another of my friends had a friend who was a teacher in an Islamic girls' school, so I was able to interview all the teachers who are, you know, niqabi women. So, you know, by virtue of being of living in a place where I could make those kind of personal connections, it was actually, you know, quite an interesting, and, you know, I wouldn't say it was an easy process. You know, I'm not Muslim. I'm sort of, you know, your regular white female researcher, who had to be in some ways checked out, right? She, you know, so a lot of women, for example, asked me for my previous work just to kind of see the style I was writing in and my arguments to make sure that I wasn't going to sensationalize them. So that was the British part, but there was some turmoil in my personal life. I knew I was going to move to the United States, and so, you know, that quite naturally that interest sort of, you know, connected to a new context or new setting, and you know, I figured it would be really interesting to do a few interviews in the United States, perhaps not to compare, but at the time, you know, there was nothing about the niqab in the United States as a religious practice, and it just seemed prudent to basically cover this sort of new geographical region, because in, you know, at the time, you know, that was probably 2017 or 18. By then, a few titles came out. There were a few reports from France and from Canada that did include quite a few interviews with niqabi women, but there was still nothing from the United States. So so that's how the book sort of became you know, framed by these two two national contexts.
I think it works well too. The you know, you're not specifically comparing them, but the kind of different contexts do kind of illuminate different things. And you know, as you mentioned, right, the kind of debates around religious practice are much more heated, especially in France, but also in parts of Canada, which you mentioned. And one of the things I really liked about the book that I thought a lot of people could kind of use in classes or just kind of in their own understanding is I feel like you get at kind of what constitutes religious practice in these different places. You know, there's a kind of different general sense of what religious practice is. And in many cases, religious dress was not always legible as this is a religious practice, rather than it being symbolic of something, right? But rather that many of the women you're talking about talk about it as this is my religious practice, where that was not always understood in that way by non-Muslim audiences. So I'm wondering if there's anything you could say just as a general feature of what do you think the book might help us understand about what constitutes religious practice, or where religious practice might be possible, or how it might be possible in the US and UK versus perhaps France or something like that.
Yeah, so, you know, I take definitely the sort of academically speaking, a constructivist view of religious practice. you know, whoever says something is their religious practice, you know, we take it at face value, especially, you know, in a case where you know, we've got something in the category of covering, and so I would say sort of generally, and you know, I'm sort of using very sort of generalist terms. Generally, few people would kind of contest the idea that, for example, the hijab is a religious practice, but there have been quite a few vocal groups, you know, taking part in those niqab controversies and debates, that would say, oh, this, you know, face covering is not a religious practice, it's not an Islamic practice. And so, you know, there were several different sort of arguments to back this up, one of them being that, you know, the Quran does not say anything about face covering, and therefore, you know, if the Quran says nothing about this, then it's not a thing. But I would sort of counter this, saying that actually, if you look at the Quran, and that's, you know, that's Asma Barlas wrote about this at length. The Quran doesn't actually say anything about head covering as such. You know, does not say much about hair covering. There's, you know, the hijab is not used in terms of, you know, as in such terms as we understand them today. So the hijab is used, you know, in the meaning of a curtain and so on. And so, you know, taking that argument that, you know, in, specifically in the Quran, there is not such an injunction that women must cover their hair, you know, we could say, and in that case, you know, the hijab is not, as it were, in the Quran. So you know, there's no difference here between these two. And yet we accept one, but reject the other. Even though those who practice face covering claim that for them it has religious relevance, and you know, explain very sort of in sophisticated ways how that happens, how they feel about it, and so yeah, I mean, it's what's striking to me is that the two groups that actually. You would not see those two groups as natural allies, those who deny the religious relevance of the niqab. One of them would were have always been these people who sort of advocated for a niqab ban or a burqa ban, you know. So, and then you've got a group of secular Muslims who sort of, you know, do not like the idea of the niqab and don't like to be associated with it because they see it as a sort of fundamentalist religious practice. And so, you know, basically to, as if to say, oh, I'm not a fundamentalist, they would say, oh, you know, niqab is not religious, it's cultural. So I've heard that from quite a few people. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, that's not their business. It's the women's business. You know, how they choose to practice their religion in this case. And so that was my sort of starting point and principle of the book. That I did not debate that. You know, I did not debate if, you know, whether, you know, in the Islamic sources, you know, whichever madhab would agree with it or make it obligatory. I mean, I made a few references to that, but that was not the point of the book. The point of the book was to understand how the women experience it. And in legal sense, especially in Europe, less so in the United States. In the United States, I think, as far as the niqab, I would say the separation of state from religion kind of works well enough, in the sense that the, you know, there was one project, there was one proposal that, you know, was shut down in Georgia, and that never really came back on the political scene again, that, you know, somebody wanted niqab banned in their state. But in Europe, as we know, the story is diametrically different. I think there are probably, I think maybe 10 or 11 countries now that have banned face covering. And some of them are explicitly targeting the Muslim community. Some of them pretend to not be targeting, and they claim that, you know, this relates to all face coverings. But you know, that's not really a very sort of honest stance. And the whole idea here, the European Tribunal of Human Rights basically protects religious practices that are sort of enshrined, right? That religious experts would agree on that they are religious practices, and therefore they will be protected. But here, the whole sort of, you know, and that's one part of that paradox. The second part of the paradox is that, of course, if anybody kind of identified the face or head covering as something instituted by religious authorities, then there would be immediately there would be, you know, a controversy that women are being forced to cover. And so Muslim women have been at pains, you know, those who do cover, they have been at pains to say, you know, that in a huge majority of cases, this is a choice. This is not, you know, this is not a sort of injunction or anything forced. They choose to cover because that kind of increases their spiritual experience. And so, you know, and by virtue of this kind of free will argument, they cannot be protected legally. And so, that's a big problem, because, you know, in countries like France or Belgium, a lot of women are kind of reported to, you know, just stay at home because they cannot participate in the public sphere in the manner that they would prefer, with covered faces. So they're kind of imprisoned in the house by law, by the, you know, the legal changes, not by their male relatives, as you know, some Islamophobes would you know, suggest that, you know, they're being kept at home, they're not allowed, they actually choosing not to participate because it's not on their terms.
You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee, and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, sneakers and streetwear so fresh, every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
While you are centering niqab wearers' voices throughout the book, you set up the conversation well, and you've already kind of pointed to some of this. But the first chapter in the book kind of covers how media generally discusses women who wear niqab, just so people can follow the kind of trajectory of the book. What would you say is the general portrait of niqab wearing women that the media has created, since they generally don't include their voices?
Well, it is definitely being sort of orientalized, otherized. I would say it's a little better these days. I have seen more niqabis kind of invited to comment on these things, on these sort of political controversies that involve them. But I would say, you know, it's still kind of a very uncomfortable representation. Talk about sort of an average article about, you know, women who wear the niqab. You know, they're still kind of portrayed as subjugated, as maybe uneducated, not necessarily speaking good English or French or, you know, whatever language is spoken in the country where they live in. And that's sort of this, you know, maybe having a lot of children and generally being kind of, you know, imprisoned at home by this kind of role of wife and mother. And not very kind of ambitious. And on the other hand, especially sort of, you know, between 2015 and maybe 17, there was a new kind of new idea how to represent these women. And that was basically to show them as fundamentalists, extremists, you know, kind of, you know, basically terrorists in hiding. So there were quite a few, you know, reports from Syria, and, you know, there was this whole avalanche of imagery of, you know, of niqabi women with weapons, and, you know, and articles, sensationalized articles about, you know, black widows and, you know, all these sort of jihadi brides and so on. So that was a very damaging sort of process. And the women I interviewed at the time said that they were worried that you know, they will get they will feel the fallout of that. They will be, you know, spat at. They will be shouted at in the street, because people will be sort of, you know, people will be kind of riled up by this imagery. So they will be easy targets. And so you know, the statistics are horrible. You know, most women who are visibly religious, Muslim women who are visibly religious, they experience some form of harassment, and you know, even things like assaults. There's an author in the UK, Irene Zempi. She writes about specifically about the kinds of you know, harassment and assaults these women experience. And so yeah, that's just horrifying. And no doubt, undoubtedly, the media representations have a hand in that. They stir those sentiments. They basically, you know, they kind of, you know, heighten aggression against them. So yeah.
And moving on, the book, you do kind of reflect on and include Niqabi women's kind of feelings about this, which you're already gesturing towards. And you also kind of plot out how they kind of step in and kind of push back against much of this negative imagery. Some of it, as you mentioned, right, is there is it sounds like increasing some Niqabi inclusive journalism that's happening. But also it sounds like social media was a kind of entrance point for Niqab wearing women to kind of speak for themselves and kind of, I guess, demystify or kind of de-centralize these negative images. Can you talk a little bit about what that process looked like? What were Niqabi women doing to kind of respond to these negative images?
Sure. So some of that work, and I wrote a few articles, you know, a few years ago about that. They actually do quite a lot of photographic work. They basically take self-portraits to show themselves in kind of mundane situations, you know, at home, in the garden, or just, you know, like regular photographs. Because and they when I first saw those photographs, you know, they struck me as unusual. You know, and why should that be, that, you know, women in mundane kind of surroundings are unusual? And that's because I realized I was already kind of formed by this kind of photographic discourse of women in niqab as you know, as a kind of other and perhaps dangerous and exotic. And so, you know, mostly the mainstream photography that would show them would focus just on the niqab. So very often you would see, like, basically a black photograph with maybe like a strip for eyes, and that was supposed to represent that woman, or just the face would be just the eyes. And by foregoing the context, the photographers contributed to this representation of these women as kind of strange, alien-like, and so suddenly these regular mundane photos on Flickr you know, popped up, and I'm like, what's so strange, what's unusual about this? And and so that was my first sort of observation about it. But of course, you know, in the age of social media, it's not just the photos, it's also about the interaction with audiences. So people were able to comment, people were able to ask questions. And I was actually surprised how positive and kind of constructive those conversations were. I assumed, again, that the conversations would be, you know, very Islamophobic, very sort of aggressive, and that the audiences would basically, you know, criticize. But actually, you know, people seem to recognize that this was their chance to perhaps, you know, ask questions and find out more about it. So this was a second kind of second observation that really, you know, was in some ways shocking, positively shocking, that you know, you could have a conversation between you know, regular non-Muslims who wanted to engage with these women who were in the cab, just sort of, you know, on a sort of very human level. So I saw that as a kind of you know, opportunity for women who are in cab to like to educate, because that's what they expressed to me in the interviews, that they really wanted to, you know, educate it, you know, the mainstream public about, you know, what this is, because they were very tired of the stereotypes. And, you know, they jumped up. They were so happy to talk with me, because they understood that, you know, this was a chance that they were being given a platform for their voices. So social media definitely is useful in the sense that, you know, there are no gatekeepers, like in the traditional media where, you know, everything has to go through the editor and, you know, the journalist, the reporter has to be interested in the topic, right, first, before anything happens. So basically they could go out there, and they sometimes even manage to kind of gain popular support by the use of hashtags. And that was the case in Canada, I think, where their prime minister said something very unsympathetic, something very stereotyped. And so somebody created a hashtag that was kind of a sarcastic response to that statement. And so a lot of people basically, you know, took up the hashtag. There was, you know, it was trending for a while, just to say that, you know, Canada is not treating Muslim women right. And so, yeah, that kind of, you know, was definitely kind of a PR success, you could say. And so, you know, these days it's nothing unusual. There are groups everywhere that kind of associated women who wear the niqab. And, you know, this is nothing kind of, unusual anymore. But that's definitely a very useful kind of option for them to kind of communicate.
Yeah. You also get into the more kind of spiritual and religious understandings of wearing the niqab for these women, which was one of your kind of central goals to understand. And you flesh this out in a lot of detail. So how do your subjects that you're talking to, how do they express their understandings of pious dress and kind of the religious explanations for their decisions to wear the niqab?
So I interviewed women who quite, you know, definitively and openly said they chose to wear the niqab. And so for 99% of them, I would say, that decision was preceded by a very lengthy period of discernment, you know, thinking about it, maybe trying it on for a little bit, reading about it. A lot of them took their time before they made that decision, and I think because they made that decision themselves based on that discernment, their spiritual experience was very kind of positive. In the sense that, you know, of course, I know that there are women who put on the niqab and then take it off. It doesn't work for them for different reasons. But the women who I spoke with said, you know, they were very sort of firm in their decision, and they were, you know, they were incredibly happy, because the way it worked for them is that they felt closer to God when they were wearing it. And so they were giving me different sort of, you know, anecdotes and examples of how, you know, they read things that happened around them as signs that, you know, God approved. And that sort of, you know, strengthened them in the decision. They definitely did not wish to be seen as people of the sort of highest religious order or spiritual order. They said, you know, they're not better by wearing the niqab than other women, you know, women who might be wearing the hijab or not covering their head at all. They said, you know, it is an incredibly personal decision, and definitely something like that, like something like covering the face, cannot or must not be instituted, because if it's instituted, it's going to be, you know, sort of, you know, just not this, not, it's not going to have that spiritual aspect. It's going to be a burden. And, you know, they very often quoted that Quranic verse that religion is not meant to be a burden for you. So yeah, I mean, sorry, I lost my train
no,
of
no,
thought.
That's great. But the other thing that that happens when your subjects are talking about this is this kind of religious explanation does not always translate in the clearest ways to non-Muslim audiences. So there seems to be this kind of communication breakdown that you point to as well, where religious perspectives are kind of almost misunderstood or not understood at all in a kind of secular framework of the US and UK that you're talking about. So maybe you could talk a little bit about this as well. You know, how do niqab wearers who are understanding this from a religious perspective help non-Muslim audiences make sense of this in this kind of these secular audiences or these secular sensibilities that don't always kind of understand it in the same way?
Yeah, so you know, these women are incredibly astute in recognizing that communication gap or disconnect, because yeah, it is there's some literature that talks about how, you know, the pious language is not understood, it's rejected, is kind of laughed at sometimes, even you know, but by your sort of mainstream member of the public. And especially I would say when it's pertains to Islam, because, you know, Islam is not just like any other minority religion, whether in the UK or in the United States. It's you know, it's 10 times more otherized and vilified than others. So yeah, religious language that comes from a Muslim very often is just treated with suspicion. And so the women who wear the niqab recognize that, and you know, they still you know, they had to communicate, and you know, the niqab is, you know, for a non-Muslim, is the first thing they see and the first thing that very often they want to sort of use as a point of connection. So Muslim women who are the niqab that I interviewed, they developed strategies to sort of translate the niqab and, you know, more largely the sort of language of piety into the secular language, because otherwise they knew that they would be misunderstood and you know, that the communication act would not happen. And so they used many different strategies. I call them frames. So they would use humor, for example, just to sort of, you know, if somebody kind of asked about the niqab and it was winter, you know, the woman would say, oh, you know, it keeps me warm and, you know, keeps my nose warm and whatever. So, you know, humor is kind of a well-recognized strategy for people who are frequently odorized to sort of, you know, to break that barrier. And of course, you know, from a sort of ethical point of view, they should not have to do that. But, you know, that is the reality that, you know, they needed to work. They needed to be out there and, you know, communicate with people. I think that particular situation with the, you know, winter was, you know, basically this woman was a driving instructor and she was just, you know, standing next to another driving instructor at the examination center. So, you know, this was kind of like a professional conversation. And yeah, it must have been highly uncomfortable for her to discuss this, but that's how she sort of batted it away. You know, other women talk about, you know, the language of human rights, of course, bodily autonomy. You know, they talk about, you know, the niqab as, you know, sort of comparing it, for example, to a tattoo, that, you know, a lot of people wear tattoos. Some people even, you know, have like a full body tattoo, and you know, that nobody's talking about banning such a full body tattoo, even though it might make some people uncomfortable. It might make it harder to recognize that person or whatnot. But yeah, they pointed out to these kinds of inconsistencies to show that, there is a lot of margin for acceptance of difference in the British and American societies, but they're kind of like the niqab is very often beyond the acceptable difference. You know, that's like a step too far. You know, the religious, and yes, we understand and we accept other religions and minorities, but this is a step too far. This is just, you know, something that kind of almost offends. And so, I would say that, you know, this was incredibly, you know, it was survival, a survival instinct, really, to learn to talk about it in ways that could be understood and perhaps accepted.
Yeah. And this, you wrap up the book kind of looking at some of these broader kind of issues of wearing the niqab in the context of things like racism and sexism and Islamophobia more generally. So can you talk about how wearing the niqab intersects with these other kind of broader kind of public issues? What are the social effects for niqab wearers in these kind of negative contexts?
Of course, you know, this is not just prejudice against minority religions. Very often it intersects with racism in different forms. One woman I interviewed said, you know, for her as an African American Muslim niqabi, you know, she's sort of like triply at risk in this country, in the sense that, you know, she could get it from so many different directions. You could say the niqab, you know, by virtue of, you know, of being kind of a covering garment, can work in different ways, I guess, for women of different racial and ethnic backgrounds. For a few Black Muslim women who I spoke with, you know, this was something that basically shielded them from racist reactions from fellow Muslims, because the more covered up they were, you know, the less racist kind of harassment they had, because, you know, there is the issue of there's the issue of anti-Black racism amongst Muslims. And so, you know, for them, actually putting on the niqab was kind of a relief, because, you know, they basically protected themselves in that way. But for a lot of, I spoke with a white convert to Islam, and she told me that for her, the niqab worked in a different way that was protective, in the sense that she got a lot of interest when she was just wearing the hijab. So she got a lot of marriage proposals and, you know, dating proposals from men. But as soon as she covered herself up with the niqab and she covered up her blonde hair, that completely stopped. So here the niqab sort of, you know, basically also covered her up in a sense that, you know, covered up her ethnic and racial sort of background. And she became sort of, I wouldn't say untouchable, but she was not recognized as somebody different within the Muslim community. But, you know, that's just sort of one kind, kind of effect it could have. For a lot of women, we talked about, you know, how the niqab makes them more or less intelligible when they're going out and about. But at the end of the day, that kind of perhaps comes down to the question of whether, you know, Islamophobia is a kind of racism. Because there will be a lot of people who say, you know, who understand racism biologically, and they will say Islam is not a race; it's a cultural construct. Therefore, you know, you might dislike Islam, but that does not make you a racist. But you know, the definition of racism that is accepted, at least, you know, in academic circles, you know, sociologically, is that it is related to sort of socially constructed perceptions and attributes that are kind of attached to people based on their kind of background. But it's by no means just biological, right? So for a lot of these women, basically, you know, racism, Islamophobia, and sexism, I would say, you know, connected and interacted in very different ways. So, you know, it's just two examples of that.
Well, it's a great book. I think you tie together so many different aspects, and you do a great job of centering your subjects' voices. I hope listeners will pick up a copy, and I think it would actually work great in classrooms as well. What kind of things are you working on now? What kind of things might we hope to read from you in the future?
Thanks for the question. I pivoted away from the issue of the niqab. And I'm really interested at the moment in the connection between conversion and white supremacy. So I'm basically looking at how white supremacy might manifest itself in the context of white conversion. And, you know, when we say white supremacy, it's often kind of associated with maybe like clean-shaven men demonstrating, you know, neo-Nazis. And certainly there is actually a population of people who, from those movements, who convert to Islam. But I'm interested in white supremacy as it kind of manifests in day-to-day life. That's a project I'm working on with my colleague Joanna Krotofil from Poland. She's at Jagiellonian University in Krakow, and we've published an article about that in relation to Polish converts to Islam. We published that in Sociology of Religion, but now we're working on a book. So hopefully within a year or two, that book will be published. And that's also a book about the Polish context, but we're hoping to make the argument about how sort of white supremacy can manifest through theologies or interactions in kind of mixed racial Muslim communities. Basically more general. That's not something that applies just to Poland, I think. That's just an example, but yeah, we will be back with a more developed argument around that.
Yeah, sounds like important work. So thank you for pursuing it, and congrats on Wearing Niqab. This was a great book.
Thank you so much. I'm glad you liked it.
That was my conversation with Anna Piella about her book Wearing the Niqab: Muslim Women in the UK and the US, published with Bloomsbury in 2021. And thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.